Herzlich willkommen beim Podcast des österreichischen Tierärzteverlags. Hier sprechen wir mit Expertinnen und Experten über Themen rund um den Veterinärbereich. Wir freuen uns, dass Sie mit dabei sind.
Herzlich willkommen zum Tierärzteverlag-Podcast. Mein Name ist Astrid Nagel. Ich spreche heute mit Dr. Lisa Moses über Empathie und Mitgefühl im tierärztlichen Alltag. Dr. Moses ist Tierärztin und Bioethikforscherin an der Harvard Medical School in den USA und sie beschäftigt sich in ihrer Forschungstätigkeit mit Ethik in der Tiermedizin und auch in der tiergeschützten Forschung. Wir bitten um Verständnis, dass das Interview auf Englisch geführt wurde. Deswegen darf ich auch nochmal gleich auf Englisch alle begrüßen. Welcome to the Tierärzteverlag podcast. My name is Astrid Nagel. Today we will talk about commonly encountered ethical conflicts in companion animal practice and about how we can handle such situations with compassion and empathy. And for this interview, may I introduce Dr. Lisa Moses. She is a veterinarian and bioethicist at Harvard Medical School in the USA. And in her research, she investigates veterinary medical ethics and animal-focused research ethics. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate your interest.
I would like to ask you first how you came to work in veterinary ethics. You are a trained veterinarian. How did that come about?
Yeah, I've had a little bit of a non-traditional path in veterinary medicine. I've been an animal health professional for well over 40 years now, a practicing veterinarian for over 30 years. And I would say before I was a veterinarian, I was an animal welfare officer in animal regulatory authority. What I would say is that even though I didn't formally get trained in ethics until well into the second half of my veterinary practice career, I was thinking about these questions for a very, very long time. And I would say in the first half of my veterinary career, I was really, really noticing how much the emotional impact of veterinary practice took a toll on my peers, not just the veterinarians, but also the support staff and everybody involved in taking care of animals. And I really, really wanted to know why that was, since we were all doing work that we really loved and wanted to do. Why was it so hard? And that really got me thinking about it. And I started exploring what then was mostly being talked about in terms of compassion fatigue. And I got trained in and started teaching other people in veterinary medicine about issues surrounding compassion fatigue. But I really realized fairly early on, and this was more than 20 years ago, that compassion fatigue, even though it did a great job of describing what a lot of people in veterinary medicine were feeling, it didn't really explain why we were feeling what we were feeling. And I started to get really interested in what was the cause of why so many people were struggling emotionally with the impacts that veterinary medicine had on us.
I have actually found myself in my practical work that I started to notice these ethical conflicts the longer I was working. Mm-hmm. Like with experience, I think maybe I even had more time to notice these ethical conflicts and concentrate on the feelings that the people around me were having. Can we maybe define the word compassion fatigue just for those of us who are not familiar with it?
Sure. Compassion fatigue, I think, is a really good descriptive term that is a little misleading, a little bit of a misnomer. What we're talking about are feelings where you lose a sense of compassion. And I think what happens is people often think that it means that you lose compassion for your patients. And that typically does not happen to people who work in veterinary medicine. What usually happens is that you lose a sense of compassion, mostly for yourself and for the people that you work with, and most importantly, for the people that you have important personal relationships in your life. And that happens as a result of the toll that the work takes on you. It is very closely akin to burnout, which I think is something that people are very familiar with. But like I said, compassion fatigue, even though it is a useful label for a lot of the feelings that people have, and it is a good sort of umbrella term for the ways in which it is hard to practice from day to day, it doesn't really tell us why people feel the way they feel.
I think it is very interesting that the compassion fatigue does not concern our patients mostly.
Yes, I agree. And I think that's some of the reason why people often resist that label. I mean, let me be clear. There are some people for whom compassion fatigue does extend to losing some sense of compassion and sensitivity to how they feel about their animal patients. But I don't think that's not the most common manifestation in veterinary medicine. I think most of the time, what we see is that lots of people in veterinary medicine still care about taking good care of the animals that they are around, but they lose a sense of being kind and empathetic with the people around them.
So would you say that concerning ourselves with ethical questions and trying to get to the root of those feelings, why is it important to consider these ethical methods?
Yeah, well, let me first expand a little bit on why I even said that it's important to get to the root at all. One thing that I think we're hearing a lot about these days, particularly from organized veterinary medicine, and even in other professions, there's a lot of talk about this, is, you know, there's lots of talk about burnout. There's lots of talk about mental health impacts of professional roles. There's lots of talk about suicide in veterinary medicine and in other professions as well. And those are very, very important. The place where I think we sometimes get this wrong, and I think it is a little bit scary to me that we get this wrong, is that we often blame this on the individual. And I think that that is really dangerous. And I think that that ignores what to me is a very important piece of this equation that we don't talk much about. The thing that I have been investigating for quite a while now is my belief, derived mostly from my research, is that the root of a lot of these negative feelings and harms that happen to us is because of our daily exposure to ethical conflict. And I think one place that veterinary medicine has not done a great job, maybe in comparison to physicians and human medicine, is that we don't have a great what's called moral imagination, meaning that we don't recognize how much of our daily practice life involves ethical conflict or even ethical dimensions. Let me give you an example. For us, particularly in the United States, where most veterinary practice is fee-for-service, most of the time in the United States, pet owners do not have pet insurance, and most of their fees are completely out of pocket. So financial constraints are an enormous part of everyday veterinary practice for companion animal patients. And if you ask most veterinarians in North America about this, they don't even recognize the fact that they have to tailor pretty much every treatment that they do to financial constraints as an ethical dilemma.
Because it's so common. It's the same here in
So
Austria. Yeah.
common.
So common.
Yeah.
It's like an everyday thing.
It's an everyday thing. But take a step back and think about it. You know, you are being asked every single day, many times a day, to change the standard of care that you think is the right and appropriate standard of care simply based on somebody's ability to pay. That is an ethical dilemma. And there is a concept that comes out of bioethics called moral distress. And there is a related concept called moral residue that I want to explain a little bit for people who are not familiar with it. Moral distress is a particular kind of emotional distress that comes from facing usually unresolved or unresolvable ethical dilemmas in the course of your professional work. My own research, and I think really just my own personal experience, tells me that veterinarians face a very high level of this in their daily work, and veterinary nurses do as well. Moral residue is a really interesting concept that I think resonates very strongly for veterinary professionals, even more so than it might for nurses, which is where this concept was originally described. Moral residue is the idea that it's a cumulative impact of if you face in your professional life lots and lots of small everyday ethical conflicts, which usually go unresolved, it leaves you with this impact that oftentimes you're not aware of until it really builds up and does harm that you are finally aware of once it reaches some big threshold level. And, you know, these are concepts that we really don't talk about in veterinary medicine. We talk about burnout and we talk about things like self-care. But we don't talk about why we need to do those things and how we've gotten to this place where people are quitting veterinary medicine or leaving practice. And I really do believe a lot of it has to do with our high level of exposure to ethical conflict and the resulting moral distress.
I also read in the studies while I was doing the research for this interview that in the studies, it turns out that all the self-care measures, the stress coping strategies that are implemented when you are suffering from burnout or mental health issues won't work as well if you have to compromise constantly between your actions and your
That's right.
own personal values or priorities. So all the hot bubble baths and mindfulness training won't work as well against your burnout symptoms if the ethical conflict, or let's say the conflicts in your work, are still going on.
Yes.
And I am translating the moral residue as something that kind of nibbles away at your self-esteem or confidence or well-being.
Yeah, so I think you're absolutely right. And I actually think you answered your earlier question, which I didn't answer with that. I think you're getting at something very important, which is something I have just really started to think about and start exploring a little bit, which is I actually think that there might be something to the idea of we are doing harm to our own identity when we repeatedly act in a way that goes against our own conscience. And when we do that for years and years at a time, and you know, I realized when I started looking into this that there's very little exploration of veterinarians' concept of self-identity once they are out in practice and once they've been in practice for any length of time. There is some amount of work, although it hasn't been updated for a while, on how veterinary students develop an identity, a professional identity. But really, there's a big hole in the literature about what veterinarians, how they actually see themselves once they've been in practice for a while. And I'm starting to be suspicious that this constant exposure to acting against your own conscience in small, small ways, but still on a regular basis, may chip away at how we see ourselves and honestly, whether or not we even see ourselves as good people.
It often feels a bit like walking a tightrope during the veterinary education because you are taught to concentrate on finding a diagnosis, you're taught to distance yourself, and you're also taught to overstep borders that you normally maybe wouldn't, like maybe restraining an animal to get a venous flow in.
Yeah. Yes.
You are overstepping bodily boundaries of this animal when you are
Yeah.
doing this. And you have to train yourself to put the needle in and
Yes.
to maintain a professional distance. And I think all of this may make it harder to then go back to the place where you're actually empathic and compassionate because you've been actually trained to keep a distance. So maybe you are just thinking that you are keeping your professional distance while you are actually compromising some values that you still could have.
Yes. So this immediately made me think of I do teach veterinary students at several schools in the US about ethics. And one of the things that I hear from them on a regular basis And I think I'm hearing this more and more as the years go on. Some of them have a real shock when they go to veterinary school and then when they graduate, that there is a very big disconnect between what they pictured in their head being a veterinarian was going to be and what it actually felt like when they got to school and when they graduated. And I think the reason that there is this big disconnect is because of exactly what you're talking about, the gap between what we teach them their professional identity should be and what their feelings and their conscience and their moral compass tells them their actions should look like. And I think we have done a lousy job of bringing those two spheres together, so that there isn't so much of a gap between those two identities.
The conflicts that veterinarians face have often been compared to that of nurses in medicine and not to that of physicians. Why is that? Why is human medicine in this case so different?
I don't know it's that much difference. I think, of course, the obvious difference is that we have the issue of there is another party, namely a pet owner, who ultimately has power to change the direction of the care. But I don't actually think it's that different. I think it is closer in some regards to a pediatrician parent-child model in terms of decision making. But I think it depends on the kind of veterinary medicine you're talking about. Because I practiced my whole career in a referral hospital where we had nurses who practiced much like nurses do in human healthcare, I don't actually think it was that different. I think it might be different if you are talking about a more traditional small practice, but I also think this may be very dependent upon whether or not you, as a veterinarian, view an owner as the person who has the ultimate and a larger piece of the decision-making agency than you do. I think I'm not a veterinarian who believes that.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's just because you have two responsibilities. One is to the animal and the other one is to the pet owner, and sometimes your compassion goes out to both of them. So
Right. I think it should.
you're kind
Yes.
of split between the two.
Yeah. Although I don't, I mean, to me, the key to that and the key to making it work for me is that I don't see it as a split. I see it as we're all on the same team. And that it's really important to me that we are all working towards the same goal. And that's the way that I can make that relationship happen in a way that doesn't feel like I have to violate my own conscience.
Yeah, can I maybe give an example so that we are talking more about concrete?
Sure.
Because what I was thinking about was a very elderly and frail lady who has an animal that needs a lot of care that she just can't provide. But if you
Yes.
take the animal away, she will suffer. But
Yes.
if you leave the animal where it is, in some way both will be happy, but the animal will still suffer if it doesn't get that level of care.
Sure. Yes. I faced that situation many, many times. So one thing I didn't say is that for the last half of my career, my practice was limited to pain medicine and palliative care.
So you're very familiar with the
I'm
problem.
very familiar with a situation like that. I think there's two important ways to deal with that. One is to be very, very creative in the solutions that you can offer to people. Without judgment. I think that's an important piece of it, is being able to have straightforward, non-judgmental conversations with your clients and say, if you are unable to bathe your incontinent dog every day so that they do not develop urine scalds, then they cannot have a good quality of life, and we need to do something different. So for me, remaining non-judgmental, having creative solutions to those kinds of problems, and finding resources to help people, those are things, that's what I did in my appointments. But the other piece of it, which I think is actually more challenging for veterinarians, is trying to look with a fresh eye at each one of those clinical situations to decide what is really bothering you about them. Let me explain what I mean. I think veterinarians, and I am certainly not saying this is a bad thing, have a very, very, very low tolerance for suffering in our patients. And I've had lots of really interesting conversations with my physician colleagues about this. Physicians expect their patients to suffer. They are not under any illusions that they can remove all suffering from their patients. They do everything they can to minimize suffering, but they don't believe they're going to remove all suffering from their patients. And I realize after years of being in this environment that that's not the way veterinarians think at all. You know, we expect our patients will never suffer. And if they suffer at all, we believe we have failed and that that is unacceptable and we need to stop everything immediately. I'm not saying that we need to leave our patients to suffer. I think we need to maybe critically evaluate how much we really can impact that and weigh the kind and the amount of suffering in a critically realistic way to decide what kind of suffering is most important for this patient and this client and decide what trade-offs are we going to make. That's what palliative care is all about. It's about making trade-offs.
And making the trade-offs with the owner, ideally.
Exactly.
In conversation or in develop
exactly.
them together.
Exactly. So, for example, a concrete way that we might put that into practice is, I might say to somebody, I do believe that your dog is in pain and that I am not able to adequately control this pain. I believe that this is suffering and I don't think we should let this go on. And if the client says to me, I understand what you're saying, it's really, really important to me that we have this weekend together because my son is coming home this weekend, then I might say, okay, I understand that. We're going to do everything we can to make things as comfortable as possible for the next 3 days, but we can't go in any further than that.
So this is a compromise that you arrive at individually and in conversation with the client.
Yes.
I think it helps to look at the cases really individually and to take the time to think about each of these conflicts individually.
That is the only way you can do it. There is no other way to do it other than on a case-by-case basis. And part of that is because everybody's values are different and everybody's goals are different. So this falls under the heading of goal-directed care. A lot of what I talk about in veterinary medicine in the clinical work is how to have conversations with clients about really getting to the root of what is important to them, what they think is important to their animal, so that you can make decisions about the course of care that honors those things. And everybody will be happier if you can prioritize those values and those goals. If as a veterinarian you are able to do that, you will feel so much better about the work you do.
This is one of the big areas where we face this distress. I think from my own experience, I can say that there is such a big spectrum from when to recommend that a patient is suffering so much that you have to take steps. And when you would really rather recommend more treatment, but maybe the owners do not want this treatment. I think there is a big spectrum between owners wanting to do everything that's humanly possible.
Yes.
And owners who would rather end the suffering. And I must say that quite often you as a veterinarian are maybe not of the same opinion. And there is a disconnect that you have to navigate somehow.
I think one of the things that maybe we need to rethink in our profession is This idea of how much we distance ourselves professionally from that conversation, and how much we present ourselves to our clients as a distant professional rather than a professional with expertise that can help them come to a decision that we make together that's in the best interest of this animal that we both care about. What I mean by that is, I think it is really okay for us to let a client know how we really feel about a situation. And I'm not talking about coercion or undue influence or pressuring them. I'm talking about telling a client that this bothers me because I don't feel like I am adequately able to control the pain. I think it is okay for people to know that. And it helps them make good decisions. But I will also say that when I was trained, so I said a while ago that I had a little bit of an unorthodox path through veterinary medicine. When I trained in pain medicine and palliative care, I actually trained in human medicine in those disciplines because the training available to me in veterinary medicine wasn't in enough depth for the kind of practice that I wanted. And I learned a lot about communication with families in my training. And one of the things that I learned in my palliative care training that I really didn't understand that has helped me so much in veterinary practice is the concept of prognostic awareness in families. And this is the idea that something that I think every veterinarian knows, but they really have never maybe heard this, is, do you know this experience of when you talk to a pet owner and you think that you have been very clear in explaining a very poor prognosis and that they understood everything that you told them and that they got it? And then you talk to them maybe an hour later or the next day, and they say something to you that makes it sound like they heard nothing that you said and that they totally didn't get it. And you wonder, wait, what happened? Didn't I explain to them yesterday that the prognosis was terrible? So what happened is that this is a very normal and expected human psychological maneuver that people do when they get bad news, where they go in and out of being able to accept this new reality of this terrible bad news. In human palliative care, the palliative care clinicians all know this. They know that one time they're going to talk to people and people will get it, and the next time they're going to talk to people and people will sound like they totally don't know what they're talking about. But it's okay. You just have to wait and they will get it. And I, so, you know, the first 15 years that I worked in critical care veterinary medicine, boy, do I wish somebody had told me that. I had many conversations standing next to an oxygen cage in the ICU where I was baffled how people were saying things to me that made no sense. So I really wish I had known that. So that's why I wanted to tell everybody that.
Yeah, it's so true. I think we all know the feeling.
Yeah.
It's good to know that it's normal.
It's a normal human thing. Yeah. The reason I'm saying this is, have patience, have compassion with people. You need to give them time. You may have to have 3 or 4 conversations. You may just need to wait another day. So even though it feels terrible that you see a patient suffering, and you cannot get an owner to be at the same place you are with what you think is the right thing to do, have faith and give it time. They will get there.
Another thing that struck me when I read your studies and also listened to a talk you gave at the Veterinary Ethics Conference a few years ago was that we could reclaim compassion for ourselves, which I think fits quite neatly into this conversation now with the palliative care. Can you talk about this a bit?
Sure. You know, this was something that was very personal to me because, like many people who study bioethics, especially clinical bioethics, I came to bioethics because I was very much troubled by what I saw going on with my own peers, you know, how much I saw people troubled around me and how troubled I was by the ethical dilemmas I was facing. And I realized that I wasn't happy with the way I was feeling about people, and that I felt like my own sense of compassion was eroding. I'm not sure that my actions were all that different. Maybe they were, but I didn't feel the same way. I felt like my empathy was not what I wanted it to be. And I didn't really realize this until many years later and many, many years of research on this and thinking about this. But it did occur to me that maybe one of the ways that we could really have some armor against the impact that moral distress has on us is by shoring up our own sense of identity of ourselves as people who first and foremost are motivated by compassion and empathy. That's what veterinarians are. But we lose that along the way, or it gets buried and covered over with all kinds of other stuff. And I just have a sense that if we can uncover that and bring it back to a more conscious place, that it will give us so much of a sense of protection and reclaim our motivation that I think it will really help us against all of the darkness of moral distress that eats away at us and makes it hard to get through the day.
Maybe we can also remember some wise person once said to me that you can only give good care if you are healthy and strong yourself.
I absolutely think that is true, but I think the part that we often forget or that we talk about is that you don't just replenish yourself by taking care of yourself, you replenish yourself with empathy.
Yes. And if you let go of the empathy, then you're like totally empty in your professional work.
Yeah, it's
You
not meaningful.
can't, yeah, it's not meaningful anymore.
Yeah.
And we are all doing this because we want it to be meaningful.
Agree. So that's really what I want people to know. I mean, it's not so much about the research, although I of course want to be able to say I didn't just make this up. But the public trusts us for a reason. I want us to be able to back that up.
Yes, and I have found that it helps to just question why we are feeling uncomfortable and just to give the space for discussion. Also, like in my practice with my veterinary nurses, when I notice that they feel distressed, there is a lot of work to be done, and there is a lot of work to be done in defining our identity and in working out these issues for the veterinary profession, because there is a reason for the veterinary mental health crisis.
Yes.
And we need to deal with these issues
Yes.
and address them on a broad basis, like not only on the personal level, but on the systemic level.
Exactly, yes.
So would you say that we can address these issues in veterinary education as well? Like, how can we prepare the students for these dilemmas they are going to face, like every day of their working lives?
Well, you know, there's a lot of things we can do. But one thing that struck me is I said earlier this idea of moral imagination, and you had said when you were talking about your nurse, the recognizing of these situations, this idea of developing your capacity to actually notice when you feel discomfort and then understand that vague sense of unease might be because an issue has an ethical dimension. Simply developing that is the skill of developing a moral imagination, is a huge thing that helps a lot. And if I could pick one thing, that we would train veterinary students to do would be to develop a moral imagination.
Because then you can question the root of the unease, and this will help a
Exactly.
lot. Yeah.
And I think more students are hearing about things like narrative medicine, which is one technique that you can use to explore those feelings of unease, with writing about it in a narrative way. And, that's just one thing. But really, I think honestly, the development of the moral imagination is the first big step.
Thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Sure.
And thank you so much. It was a very inspiring conversation. I hope for all your listeners as well. Thank you again, Dr. Moses, for your time and this inspirational talk.
Thank you so much. I hope people get something out of it. Thank you for having me.
Das Interview führte Doktorin Astrid Nagel. Schnitt von Fiona Slapota, produziert vom Österreichischen Tierärzteverlag. Wenn Ihnen der Podcast gefallen hat, freuen wir uns über eine gute Bewertung auf Spotify oder Apple Podcasts. Gerne können Sie uns Ihr Feedback auch per E-Mail unter office@tierarzteverlag.at zukommen lassen. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören und bis zum nächsten Mal.